The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
My next guest is a celebrated biographer, having written about lives as diverse as the pirate queen Grace O'Malley and Tom Cruise, not the actor, but her own pretty unknown uncle. And now she's written her own story, which looks at how her biographical subjects have impacted her own life. Anne Chambers, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Pleasure to be here, Pat.
You've called your book Living Lives, subtitled A Biographer's Journey. How did you get into the business of biography?
Well, it's very strange how, I suppose, history repeats itself both on a personal basis and, as you were talking earlier, on a political basis. I was a junior executive officer in the Central Bank of Ireland during the time of Ken Whittaker's governorship. Tapped me on the shoulder one morning, asked me into his office, which I presumed was to tell me I was sacked or something. Junior executive officers had much contact with the governor. And he heard I was from Mayo. We started talking about the Mayo countryside and particularly the coastline. And we came to Clare Island and I said, that's where the Pirate Queen lived. And I only knew her through folklore, going there on holidays myself as a kid. And I said to Ken Whittaker, someday I'm going to try and find out, did she really exist? Because she wasn't in our school history books. And he put his finger up, as Ken Whittaker would do, and said, why are you saying sometime? Why don't you do it now? So in my early... In the mid-1970s, in my own early 20s, I set off on the voyage to find Grace O'Malley.
Did you stay in the Central Bank?
I stayed in the Central Bank and I wrote five biographies during that time. And in 1972, I made the big decision then to take on the precarious life of a full-time writer.
Now, the Pirate Queen, trying to get to the essence of something and the truth of something, and you find yourself looking at English archives and there... A light bulb moment.
Well, they are really. I started off with Grace O'Malley was written out of history for lots of reasons. The 16th century has no flag, no ideology to follow. It was a divided society of Gaelic clans all fighting one another as quick as they would fight the incoming English. So consequently, Grace O'Malley couldn't have that flag. She wasn't a nationalistic character. She was there in a time that we can see happening now in Iran, in Ukraine, the takeover of a country. You know, you have all of that repeating itself, and she had to operate within that. So consequently, the records of her are in the Elizabethan state papers. And it was like starting anew to learn a new language, because English didn't become standardized until the 18th century. So I was looking at dialect English. And it was totally written in a totally different way that we write English today. And I had to really learn a new language. But doing that, it opened up. I found the woman behind the Pirate Queen. And as a biographer, that's what I was interested in. The daughter, the mother, the wife, the widow, the lover, the grandmother.
And the first thing you had to find out, is she real? Was she real? And yes, she was. I mean, this discovery... A most famous feminine sea captain called Granny O'Malley, famous for her stoutness of courage and person, with three galleys and 200 fighting men, either in Scotland or in Ireland, she brought with her husband for 23 living as well as by land as by sea. Well, more than Mrs. Mate with him. This was a notorious woman in all the coasts of Ireland.
That was the very first introduction to Grace O'Malley. And what an introduction. If I was writing fiction, what people would say over the top. This was the Lord Deputy, the English Lord Deputy of Ireland, Sir Henry, the famous Sir Henry Sidney, who met Grace O'Malley in 1577 in Galway. And that's what he put in. But he added also, this woman did my son, Sir Philip, the famous courtier, the beloved of England at the time. He met Grace O'Malley. This young man sat down and spoke to this woman. And what they spoke about, we don't know, but he brought it back to court.
Now, the question that is always asked is about the encounter with Queen Elizabeth I. Was it Oscuelga or was it in Latin?
Oh, no. Grace O'Malley both wrote or understood and spoke English. That is quite obvious. There's never a need for a translator when she meets up with the military and administrators from the Tudor government here in Ireland at the time. And when she went to Elizabeth, there is no mention. I found one of the highlights of my research with Grace O'Malley, and here we are talking always about Grace O'Malley. It was the letter written by Queen Elizabeth confirming the meeting in 1593 in Greenwich Palace and also talking about her. And, you know, there's a little, I suppose, feminine competition there because Elizabeth is the same age as Grace O'Malley. They're elderly women at this time. That's when they met as elderly women. And she says, I must have sympathy for this poor aged woman. So I love these little things that come out of these official documents, you know.
Now, let's go back to a young woman. In 1918, while still a student, practicing her scales at the open window of the hotel room, she was overheard by Emma Corelli, director of the Opera House. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about my fellow townswoman, Margaret Burke Sheridan. And I was asked to write her biography for her centenary in 1989, and I was only given 2 years to do that. So I had to get my time off from the Central Bank, which was a bit of an aberration then, and I had to negotiate that, unpaid, of course. And I set off on my tour around Italy, in all the great opera houses from La Scala down to Naples to Rome. And what you mentioned there, Pat, was she was a young student in Rome singing, and I visited the same room she was. She sang that little octave. And Emma Corelli, it backed on to the Rome Opera House. And Emma Corelli had a problem that a lot of opera people had at the time. Her soprano went ill. And in 4 days' time, she took this young student from Ireland and she ingrained in her every detail about Mimi in La Bohème. And Sheridan went and performed that before the King of Italy, indeed, as well, in 1918 in the Rome Opera House. And I stood on the same stage. And my goodness, it's a very intimidating, no more than La Scala. And there she took off in her fantastic career throughout Italy.
How big did she become?
Well, now, I interviewed the famous Renata Tebaldi, who was Maria Callas's great competitor, really. And she told me that Puccini's daughter told her that her father considered Margherita Sheridan the butterfly of all time. And she goes into operatic history because she made the first electrical recording of the full opera of Madame Butterfly later on in her career. She was very close to Puccini when I visited the old town of Cento, where she performed his Manon Lescaut. They told me that old people in the town remembered he brought her drawn by horses in a lovely carriage, and the people took the horses out of the carriage and they continued with the two of them right through the town. And that little memory is there. And I have to say, sadly, here in Ireland, she is forgotten and overlooked.
How did she end her life? Where did she live? Because obviously the voice of a soprano, it doesn't last forever. No. So retirement always beckons at a time.
She did. And she had a few medical, as a lot of sopranos do at the time. And she was advised to come back here to Ireland during World War II. And there she had a very negative, really, retirement in that 1950s Ireland. And eventually got over to America, above all places. And she was, I've contracts from the Met for her to sing in on the, not on the operatic stage, but on the concert platform like John McCormick had been doing. But she wouldn't accept it. She used to say, how can I sing without my cloak? And the cloak was all the paraphernalia of the operatic stage. So she had a patron. And she put her up in the Shelburne Hotel because she was suffering from breast cancer. And we had none of the music authorities in this country were going to do anything for Puccini's 100th anniversary of his death and his relationship with Margaret Burke Sheridan. I have letters from him in her archive and everything like that. So a few friends of ours, with the help of the Shelburne Hotel, we put on a concert in her memory for the Puccini last November.
And in her Dublin apartment, there were imaginary servants.
Oh, there were, yes. There was Margaret, the housekeeper from Galway, and there was Mimi from France, the French maid. And it, depending on her humour at the time, one or other of them answered the phone call from friends who might want her out for lunch or something like that. She had there were fantastic people I interviewed during the 1989 centenary. You know, Joe Lynch, Welsh from RTE, remembered her when she would go into, when RTE was down there beside the GPO, and she went in there to try and get her records played. She felt that RTE were kind of ignoring her at the time, and Joe Lynch remembers carrying up her records there, and so many other people who were thankfully alive then.
Who was the original Tom Cruise?
The original Tom Cruise was an older brother of my mother, whom I never knew, and he had emigrated to America and done very well for himself in setting up the first supermarket chain up in Massachusetts. But in out of the blue, changed direction and enlisted in the American Air Force to become a pilot. And there were loads of letters that my grandmother had kept from his death down in a place down in Florida, Key West in Florida. And that's where he died. And nobody knew a thing because his body couldn't be brought back. So I set off to try and find him. And I went down to Key West and visited the actual place of his crash and the reasons why he changed. He became more American than American Pie.
Now, back to your beginnings as a biographer and T.K. Whittaker, you wrote about him.
Well, it was like my journey in biography coming full circle. I was approached by a publisher to write again something about Ken Whittaker. Well, that took 3 years to do. And my goodness, the man covered so many aspects of modern life in Ireland. It was incredible. I remember nights when I had a notebook beside the bed and something had hit me in the morning to ask him, because I did 60 hours interviews with him. And he gave me all his personal papers, unrestricted, to look at. And indeed, he didn't read the biography himself until it was in the shops. So Ken Whittaker really, I suppose, looked on me as a biographer and was happy that I go with it.
Didn't have a lot of time for Charlie High.
Well, no, they had their ups and downs. But, you know, at the same time, Whittaker would be very objective about it. But they would have clashed when he was governor of the central bank, because Charlie Haughey was minister for finance at the time, and he wanted to take over his department to take over credit policy, which was central bank. And Whittaker said, no way. And when he persisted, Whittaker said, I'm resigning if you persist. So
you've written a lot about the Irish aristocracy. Are they misunderstood?
Oh, I think forgotten here. At arm's length, my book, I interviewed 14 descendants of the present day of our aristocracy. You know, every country has an aristocracy. Grace O'Malley belonged to the aristocracy. She was the daughter of a ruling chieftain. And it was a great insight, really, into how it happened. And I interviewed the 32nd great-grandson in descent from the last High King of Ireland, Brian Boru, who could tell me that he felt at arm's length in his own country. And with a name like Chambers and Cruz, it certainly got me to reassess my own sense of nationality as assess his.
Well, it's a very entertaining read. It's more about your subjects than it is really about you, isn't it?
Of course. Nobody's interested in reading about me. No, they're interested in my journey through these remarkable people, a lot of them who have been ignored by our past for various reasons. And I'm only delighted that I've written them back in.
Yeah. And it shows that no matter how far back you go, there is always something to be found.
There's always something to be found and hopefully to learn from, because as you know, Pat, history has the implacable way, and we see it today, of repeating itself. And sadly, we never learn from our past.
Well, the book is very entertaining. It's called Living Lives, subtitled A Biographer's Journey. It's published by Red Stripe and it's available everywhere. Anne Chambers, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure as always, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.